6 in Boston.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. In the remote mountains of northern Afghanistan, an estimated 50,000 people are surviving on bread and porridge made from grass and straw. Many are sick, some are dying. Meanwhile, international aid agencies say they have the food and resources and huge challenges of ingenuity and security getting it through. The problem? Standing squarely between aid and its destination are warlords, thieves, bandits, a government not in control of its own country, and a severe lack of resources in Afghanistan that makes any outside good, from seeds to radios to blankets, a precious commodity and a clear target for pillage. Still, despite all the roadblocks, aid agencies say they are getting through somehow. I spoke with Jordan Day earlier today. He's a spokesman with the World Food Program, a United Nations agency in Kabul. I asked him what's happened to the millions that were reported about to starve if aid didn't come before the Afghan winter set in.
We've been successful at getting food into the hardest to reach areas in Afghanistan, the mountainous areas. That's in the central part of the country and in the northeast. We have spent the last 3 months really focusing on those areas, and our target has been reached. In fact, in December, we moved a record amount of wheat into Afghanistan. The previous high for Afghanistan, just to give you a little bit of perspective, was 27,000 tons of wheat. And in the month of December, we moved 118,000 metric tons.
What lengths are you having to go to get to the food to the people who need it?
We're doing a number of things. There are some areas of Afghanistan that are just traditionally cut off in the winter because of the high snowpack. We've brought in Swedish road clearing teams, brought in an avalanche control team. We've used airlifts, and we may even be using helicopters here shortly to do rapid assessments in areas where we think there's high vulnerability. In many of the highland areas, what we do is we dispatch food to a certain local town, and from there, our humanitarian partners, non-governmental organizations, take the food and will distribute it throughout that village. And often what that requires is bringing donkeys down from the village or even hiring donkeys locally to take it up.
We've heard stories, Jordan Day, of aid groups feeding people in one village until they're strong enough that the people themselves can carry food to the next. Is that part of the scene as well?
There's certainly a number of isolated villages, and Afghanistan is a country where the people are often sort of joined together to help each other survive. Certainly sharing goes on, and they certainly share resources to get food from one village to the next. And our role is to make sure the food gets to the village level and that it can then be distributed, and there's any number of ways that that then happens. We are concerned about certain villages in some of these highland areas that are traditionally socked in by snow in the winter that that will be really hard to reach. Some villages are 4 or 5 or 6 hours away by donkey, and the people that are living in those villages are certainly going to be vulnerable, and they've lived through 3 years of drought, 23 years of war. So it's a challenge. It's a big challenge. But overall, we're doing well. We have enough food stocks in the country to get us through. We've been largely able to keep some of these mountain passes open that we thought might close, and that's been due to some of the equipment we've got here, certainly a product of the nice international response that there's been to Afghanistan.
What about the human element here? We've heard about food supplies being stolen by bandits, by warlords. There must be a lot of negotiation that goes on to get food down the roads and into these areas. Tell us about that. Give us a sense of how that works on the ground.
When you're doing humanitarian assistance on this scale, in this kind of environment, a post-war or even, in fact, during a war in many parts of this country, you have to take into consideration in your planning that you are going to have some food that's diverted, some food that's taken. And we had the prospect of slowing down deliveries and ensuring that the ground was ideal for delivery versus the absolute need for food. And we decided to err on the side of making sure we got food in there. We're certainly going to have some losses due to warlords, some losses due to diversion. But frankly, it's a small percentage. I mean, we're delivering 200,000 metric tons for the last 3 months.
Does that mean that big truck convoys are rolling? Are you having to pay bribes to get through checkpoints? Are you having to give away some of the food to get the rest of the food where it needs to go? How's it work?
By and large, we're not having to. We've certainly had incidents where there have been, authorities that present themselves that want some sort of transit fee, $100, $150. But by and large, that has not been the case. We certainly work with local governors. We work with local mayors. We explain that it's humanitarian assistance, that it's for the needy of Afghanistan. And in general, we've gotten a good response. And when there hasn't been a good response, we work with the tribal warlords. We work with the governors, and we make sure that they understand where the food is going.
We're still reading reports and seeing the photographs of people eating grass. Where's that going on and why?
That's true. There are people up in the northern parts of Afghanistan. Like I said, they're in remote villages. There's food that's nearby, but it's still difficult to get it up to them. And eating grass and mixing it with wheat flour and making bread is one of the coping mechanisms, as we say, that some Afghans have used in the past, and they're using it again now. We have averted widespread famine, but there's still a big job ahead. This is a country where, 6 million people are in need of food assistance.
How long will the food emergency go on in Afghanistan?
Well, we are certainly hoping for a good spring harvest. I mean, Afghanistan is a country that used to be food self-sufficient, and 85% of the people that live in Afghanistan are subsistence farmers. So the March planting season that will come due in June is an incredibly important period of time here. We need rain. Farmers need to have seed. They need to make sure that their land is not mined. And we need irrigation infrastructure to be repaired. That all comes together. When we have a good rain, that will provide productive harvest. If not, then we're looking at the same thing that we're looking at right now, which is another 6 or 7 or 8 million people that need to be fed.
Jordan Day works with the United Nations World Food Program in Afghanistan. He spoke to us from Kabul. International aid workers in Afghanistan, faced with epic distribution challenges, are tapping into their creative side, disguising shipments, bribing warlords, and scrambling to hire donkeys to pass through regions where trucks are turned away. But at what cost, and how effective is all the finagling? How far should workers go to deliver the aid? And what does the aid obstacle course tell us about Afghanistan's future? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To talk more about the challenges facing relief workers, we're joined now by Jerry Martone in New York. He's the Director of Emergency Response for the International Rescue Committee, a U.S.-based aid organization. Welcome, Jerry Martone.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. Also joining us tonight in studio is our special guest news analyst, Juliet Kayyem. She's Executive Director of the Executive Session on Domestic Preparedness at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Welcome, Juliet Kayyem.
Good evening.
Jerry Martone, take us into the wilds and challenges of the country you've just returned from, Afghanistan. We've all waited with bated breath to see if the aid would get through. It appears that a lot of it is getting through. What are the challenges? How is that happening? Take us right down to the ground where you and your colleagues have been working. What's it taking to make the aid move?
Well, your previous Jordan Day just spoke about, one of the problems is has been a pretty impressive food logistics effort. So a lot of food has been brought in.
That's a problem?
Well, the problem is now that is a reliance on external aid. So there's a dependency. Mm-hmm. And it's something we know that can't go on forever, that there has to be a movement towards self-reliance. People have to start producing. One of the things that happened as a result of the drought and the severe food scarcity is that Afghans, the farmers, have eaten their seeds. So they actually don't have seeds for the next planting.
Mm-hmm. When is the next planting period, Jerry?
Well, now is winter wheat should have gone in the ground just a couple weeks ago.
So that's been missed if they didn't have it.
Correct. And then an additional planting late February, beginning of March. So we'll be racing to get that done as well.
So in the meantime, without their own crops coming up or until they come up, people need food. And there's this whole scheme that we hear about of thieves, of warlords, of bandits, of unemployed mujahideen, you name it, and not much of a government in place, and not a big apparent commitment on behalf of the U.S. military to help aid get through, and not enough U.N. troops on the ground to ensure that. So what are your people and others doing on the ground? We've heard you use the phrase smart aid in describing how things actually get done. How's it work?
Well, we've learned in many cases over the past 20 years of different scenarios, Somalia being a really stark example of just how much theft and diversion of aid could happen, mm-hmm. but also happened in Liberia and several other countries. And we had to learn to provide assistance that would not be diverted and used to feed these ruthless demagogues that were harming the very people we intended to help. So it's inspired a great deal of innovation and creativity among aid workers.
Give us the tricks of the trade in the postmodern chaos of our world.
Sure. The easiest initial solution is to not create a system that's entirely dependent on assets and commodities. So we don't want people to be waiting for things. So when they have seeds, that the yield, the production from that is so much greater. Mm-hmm. It also has less of an appeal for theft or diversion. A lot of these insurgents or rebel groups are not interested in planting. They're not interested in farming themselves. Mm-hmm. During the siege of Sarajevo, there was a real problem. All the city was surrounded by Serbs, and you had to pass a Serb checkpoint to enter the city. Truck convoys would enter, and they would the Serb checkpoints would demand a toll of one-third to one-half of everything that was on the vehicle. They had to be offloaded. Mm-hmm. So essentially you were feeding the Yugoslav army.
Because the trucks were carrying ready-to-eat food or something close
exactly.
to that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, so we started bringing in seeds instead. The International Rescue Committee said, well, why not bring in seeds? And these seeds were coated with organophosphate, pesticides.
Not very appetizing.
And it couldn't be eaten, that was for sure. And it was very exciting because here you have a city that's essentially dormant. People don't have any productive things to do throughout their day. Now you give them lots of seeds, and it was a wonderfully heartening sight to drive around Sarajevo and see cemeteries and soccer fields all cultivated, and people, every patch of dirt they could find, they were growing crops.
We can only hope that happens in Afghanistan, but what about in the interim? There are months before those crops come in. If you're just sending them pesticide-covered seeds, what do they eat? Are there other ways to get edible food in that make it less attractive to bandits, warlords, and the gang?
Yeah, I mean, just if you're just on the subject of grains, now the diet's mm-hmm. a lot more complicated than just
sure.
grain. There's mm-hmm. animals as well. But yeah, there are, for example, rice in many African countries is a great deal of theft and diversion of rice because it's a very dear commodity. You substitute bulgur, which is less desirable, mm-hmm. equally nutritious, mm-hmm. but has no resale value, has no appeal to some of these sinister men that tend to steal them. The same is true for corn. Use sorghum instead. So there's other ways to substitute.
Just make it a little rougher menu, and even bandits may turn up their nose at it.
Right. And in some cases, we even do what's called wet feeding. So you actually have prepared food. So it's not going to – people can't steal. It has to be eaten at the time.
We heard a story about was it protein bars that were going into Afghanistan? Do I have that right, that were somehow camouflaged?
This was in once in South America and also in Africa. It was high-protein biscuits, and they were being stolen by soldiers and eaten. And one organization cleverly relabeled them, the packaging, as women's biscuits, and that seemed to defy the theft.
Real bandits don't eat women's biscuits.
Right. Real bandits also don't steal pink radios. And one organization painted all their communication equipment pink, and then they stopped having stuff stolen.
You know, it's a good thing that men are so manipulable.
Isn't it? Yeah.
No comment here.
Juliet Kime, what do you hear? Here's the evolution of aid delivery, getting into a lot of ingenious delivery systems. And I guess you do what it takes.
Absolutely. I think... You know, when we think about military missions, and at least the way we've talked about this war, good and bad, black and white, I mean, what's happening now is the harder part, the gray areas. How much is acceptable loss of goods as you're trying to deliver goods and services to people? How much do you care about aid or humanitarian aid? And as someone said earlier, you know, the sort of bigger issue of how is Afghanistan going to sustain itself into the future, this nation-building issue. And I'll tell you, Karzai, the new leader, is no idiot when it comes to this. He knows that he needs to work with some not-so-good people to survive.
We'll come back and talk about that, about what Helmut Karzai will find for allies, what aid agencies are finding for allies. We're talking about the challenges of getting aid into the needy in Afghanistan. If part of every truckload of food ends up in a warlord's pocket, are you still willing to contribute to pay for this aid? Are there ethical limits to measures aid agencies should take to deliver it? Are you just glad it's getting there? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the Afghan aid effort and the incredible lengths to which aid agencies are having to go to get food, shelter, seeds through the obstacle course of warlords, bandits, and as yet still not very powerful central government to help folks in Afghanistan after the war has begun to wind down. The question is, are we doing enough for the Afghan people post-war? And maybe should the U.S. military be dispatched to help get the food through? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Talib is on the line. Welcome, Talib. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
Good, good. I just wanted to add this in here. I really believe that this whole humanitarian aid effort should actually be a United States military operation. And here's why. Mm-hmm. In order for the campaign against terrorism to reach its full potential, I really believe that it's going to take more than just bombing the al-Qaeda network and sending a message that we're not going to tolerate any of their terrorism on our soil. Mm-hmm. But it's actually affecting some preventative measures that this way Afghanistan doesn't become once again a haven for terrorist activity. Mm-hmm. Where does the terrorists thrive? They thrive in areas where people are destitute, they're desperate. And throughout history, that has been the case. I mean, look at Germany. Hitler came to power and rose to power when the people of Germany were at
down and
worst.
Out. Mm-hmm.
They were down and out. So I think if we are really going to profess to have a war on terrorism, we've got to go all the way. There is no way UN aid workers should be making deals with warlords. Those are the real terrorists. Mm.
Talib, you make a great point, and let's put it to Jerry Martin. He's just back from Afghanistan. Jerry, this surely is something that aid workers talk about when they sit out under the stars at night in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. wondering how to get the next truck convoy through. And the U.S. military and U.N. troops are not much in evidence in supporting that effort, as far as we know. But do you agree with Talib? Would it be an appropriate role for U.S. troops or more U.N. troops to be involved in providing security, riding shotgun for the aid delivery?
Well, I think that just buys into the simplified myth that the problem in Afghanistan is merely a logistics one. It's a problem of transportation and supplies, and that's not the case.
Oh, good. Well, take us deeper.
Yeah. Well, it's a question. It's not a food deficit as much as it is a food production deficit. As Jordan Day mentioned, 85% of Afghans are farmers. It is the loss of their livelihood as a result of war and drought that has to be replaced.
Are you saying then that the military can't bring back agriculture and so it's not really useful here?
Well, the military has extraordinary logistics capabilities. Mm-hmm. This is what they're designed to do. They're not designed, however, to do the intensive agricultural extension work, irrigation, seed multiplication programs, develop animal banks where animals can be multiplied, teach farmers high yield growing techniques, distribute small earth tools to help farmers. That's not a military function. It's not something they're good at. It's not a grassroots connection that they typically make.
Jerry, hang on. I want to bring Talib back in and see what he thinks of that view. Talib?
I disagree with that. I think we have a very talented Army Corps of Engineers, although they're not experts in the areas of agriculture, of high-end agriculture, but I'm sure we can get some Marines to dig some ditches pretty quickly. And what the Afghans are faced with now is not necessarily subsistence farming, because that, you know, one of your guests there said that that doesn't come till March. What they're faced with now is surviving until March, so that this way they can finally start farming.
But Taleb, Jerry's suggesting kind of that what you're suggesting is turning the Marine Corps into the Peace Corps. Is that going to happen?
Well, it's not even so much into the Peace Corps. I think that if we're going to do a thorough job, because too many times I see our fantastic military. I love our military. Mm-hmm. They fight and they give their lives. Too many times we send our military to do missions and then leave the people destitute. I think maybe we need to add into the function of the military not only destroying the enemy, but helping to begin the rebuilding process for the people that we're aiming to help, that we so profess to help.
Taleb, you make a strong case. And Jerry, I want to put it to you once more. I guess let's ask it this way, just very simply. Is there, on both fronts, is there anything more that you, as a guy who works hard on the aid front, would like logistically or would have preferred logistically from the U.S. military in getting food aid in? And what about future prospects? Would you like to see the Army Corps of Engineers brought in to repair damaged fields and irrigation systems and all that, or not? And if not, why not?
Well, they actually are extraordinary at it. This type of road work, civil engineering, logistics, movement of enormous quantities of things. But again, we're reducing the problem of Afghanistan to merely one that requires that type of muscle.
Well, I don't
brain.
Think it's really a matter of reduction. Taleb is saying, wouldn't this assist even a long-term aid program if the same muscle that was put into bombing was put into helping, rebuild some infrastructure here? And you're saying, no thanks, we don't want it?
Well, I think Afghans are supposed to build their own country. And I think what we should be attempting to do is be a catalyst to that process, not dig ditches for them, but facilitate that process. They're very hardworking, rugged people, and they're quite capable of helping themselves. We need to be a midwife to that process, not to do it for them. That actually would create resentment. They don't want handouts. They don't want it done for them. They want to help themselves. They want to thrive and be self-sufficient. Self-reliance is our goal. This humanitarian assistance is about restoration. Mm-hmm. It is not merely saving lives. It's restoring livelihoods. Mm-hmm.
Juliet Keim, here in our studios, what's your view on the way in which the U.S. military has been employed in Afghanistan? I guess we've learned a lot in the last 10 or 15 years over different kinds of peacekeeping, nation-building deployments. It's been pretty much a straight-down-the-line military function that they've performed there to make way for aid and reconstruction. Do you think that's the right deployment of that asset?
Right. I think we're starting to see it in Afghanistan, at least through the UN and certainly with the Brits. I mean, one of the fundamental aspects that's going on in Afghanistan right now is the simple question, not just of food, clearly, but of security. And we're starting to hear reports that a lot of single men are coming back over the hills from Pakistan into Afghanistan to determine the safety levels, will go back, get their wives.
Whether it's safe enough to bring their families home.
I think the military has a fundamental role in sort of ensuring that sort of basic security level. And we're seeing that with what the UN and the sort of peacekeeping efforts. That's absolutely essential. But I don't think that we should get I think we need to give Karzai and this provisional government some time to figure out how they are going to, you know, they only got 6 months, let's be clear here, until the next salvo.
As an interim government.
As an interim government, right. Mm-hmm. Karzai and his government may not be perfect, but they certainly are the best that we've got. And what we can do in Afghanistan now, and this is where I do agree with Taleb, is we really do have to practice what we preach in terms of not abandoning Afghanistan at this point. Afghanistan's problems happened well before September 11th. They've had famines for years, civil wars, everything. But what's Karzai's appointment and where Afghanistan is going is really is a fight between sort of moderate Islamic states, states that want to look to the future, and what the Taliban represented. If we abandon them, I think it's not only a bad thing in terms of, you know, government structures, but it is the kinds of governments that breed terrorism, that breed the kind of terrorists that we saw coming out of September 11th. You know, bin Laden found Afghanistan for a reason. It was a welcome place to be.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Martone, Juliet Keim, stand by for a moment. We're joined now by Panos Mumtsis. He's spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Welcome, Panos Mumtsis.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us. So here we are. Help us sort this out. The reports, the kind of gist of reports in the last week or 10 days from Afghanistan seem to suggest a sort of descent into chaos and this concern that the West, the United States in particular, may be seen or may in fact be abandoning Afghanistan once the bombing is finished. How do you see it from your perspective with the UN, Panos Mumtsis?
I think that Afghanistan has been obviously for a long time in a lot of tension. Going back to many years, there have been a lot of arms around, there has been a lot of fighting, and the people, the civilians, have really suffered for a long time. So for the last 10 days, we have seen new refugees, new people, people who are fleeing and escaping right now from Afghanistan into Pakistan.
We had I want to be sure I understand you. You mean people leaving Afghanistan after the new interim government is there, after the Taliban has been defeated, and now they're leaving? Why?
That's correct. The people who arrived at the border, they told us that there are some areas, some pockets within Afghanistan, particularly in the area around Kandahar, where the situation is not safe for them, and they felt that they had no other option. Also, at the same time, there are several areas within Afghanistan where humanitarian aid has not reached yet. And some of the people who arrived at the border, they told us they left basically because of famine. Hmm. Obviously, the humanitarian agencies, all the relief effort, everybody is doing their best to get the aid in all areas as soon as possible. But there are places where security is still a major issue. And, people are scared and they just decided to leave.
So, Panos Mumtsis, don't be too bound by diplomatic nicety here. Do you think that U.S. troops or more U.N. troops ought to be now deployed to raise the level of security to the point where aid and development can be more effectively delivered and encouraged?
I think it has to be a very, very careful and balanced approach, because the last thing we want to see is a repetition of what happened in Somalia, where, the local people are very upset, and we all know how the Afghan people are very proud. So I think They have to be included, they have to be involved, they have to try for themselves with support from the outside world. I think the United States, the international community, the European countries, all the wealthy countries in the world have a huge responsibility to provide the financial means so that this country could get back to its track. Because obviously with the Taliban, with the Cold War conflict, with the drought, The people of Afghanistan have suffered tremendously. And even today there is over 3.5 million Afghan refugees who are outside the country. These are millions of people who are living in camps. Some of them have been living for about 20 years, waiting for the day where there will be peace and stability and some basic infrastructure. The people are asking questions like, would there be clean water? Mm-hmm. Would there be a school for my son or daughter to go, in particular daughter, since the girls have not been allowed to go to schools? Would there be a health clinic somewhere where, it's very minimal, very basic?
Yeah, hospital.
And then, of course, the huge problem of landmines. There are millions and millions of landmines all over, and we're afraid that there would have been even possibly new landmines laid out even in the recent conflict.
Well, with all of that, let us ask you then, Panos Mumtsis, is the international community properly arrayed to come in and deliver the kind of assistance that will make Afghanistan a viable nation, a place that refugees will return to and residents will stay in?
I think at this very moment there is a lot of goodwill from the international community to do everything they can. What worries us and what we have seen in other operations like, Rwanda and other places is that usually a year or 2 years later there is another conflict somewhere else or, everybody switches off their mind into their own problems and the problem is forgotten. I mean, look at Rwanda today. 5 years ago there was a genocide. Today there is so little aid that goes there. We don't want to see the same thing happening in Afghanistan. And we would like to have a sustained interest from the world community, the major donors, for a long time to help these people come out of the situation.
Panos Mumtsis, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Panos Mumtsis is spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. Let's turn there. Michael is on the line. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was curious about the refugee issue also. because my understanding is 2 months ago in northern Afghanistan, there were 500,000 people cut off by the snowfall and conflict that was happening in the area. And I was curious as to what happened to those people in those provinces.
Good question. Let's put it to Jerry Martone. Jerry?
Yeah, most of them. One of the reasons why the month of December had the highest food import, I think it was well over 120,000 metric tons, was for that very reason, was to anticipate that there would be closure of some of the mountain passes. So there was an attempt to get the food in.
And did it get in?
A lot of it got in. A large majority did get in, but there are many isolated villages and places that are inaccessible, and people are resorting to more primitive coping mechanisms, what we call pre-famine warning signs, where they're collecting bugs and termites and grasshoppers. As I say, they've eaten their seeds, they're slaughtering their last remaining animals, they're eating wild fruits, and in some cases, animal fodder.
Jerry, let me ask you, kind of off of Michael's question, you know, we all wish the aid agencies the best of luck. It means life or death for people that we want to care about there, and we contribute. But is there always full candor on the part of the aid agencies with the donor part of the world? We heard in early December that if aid didn't get through immediately, or this was November, the passes were going to close and millions would be at risk. And somehow that seems to have evaporated. What happened? Was there a PR spin going on there, or did people just get the stuff through?
Well, there's always that question of did you cry wolf? And you can't know that because of the success of, in fact, a very robust and aggressive response by many agencies, and World Food Program, as well as other agencies. Our agency, International Rescue Committee, moved enormous amounts of food, something that we don't typically do. We tend to focus on other public health interventions.
So you have to warn of the risk. You have no choice. It's your job to do that. And then if you succeed, good on you.
Correct. Rather than was it sensationalized or was it exaggerated? But I think that one of the earlier comments that Panos mentioned, you know, the comparison to Somalia, which the comparisons are quite striking, with a large U.S. military presence and a generous charitable response from agencies, is the question: will we be able to go the long haul and get beyond just now the visible crisis while it's in the spotlight?
Are you optimistic?
I am, but we have to think a little differently. I mean, we're forced to the convention of the way this is viewed is who's harmed by war. There's these ruthless, sinister people who rob, who are the bandits responsible for the war, and then they're the innocent victims. A better model is what's called a war economy. Don't say who's harmed by war. Who's harmed by peace? Who are the black marketeers, the profiteers? Who is profiting from this situation? There is a winner. And if we just see this as anarchy, we're not looking one level deeper.
So what are you saying, that we have to go after the profiteers and somehow lock them up or shut them down?
Just the opposite. Just the opposite. Re-engage them in more constructive pursuits. They thrive on the war economy. They need this situation. What we learned in Somalia and Liberia and Sierra Leone, when there was a great deal of theft of our assets, our vehicles, our commodities, was we needed to do what was smart aid and enlist them, rent vehicles from them, have them do our heavy lifting for us.
Make them part of the effort and maybe ultimately get them back on the farm. We're talking about the aid effort, the immediate aid effort, and the longer-term aid effort required to bring Afghanistan back up off its knees. Are we delivering on our promise not to abandon Afghanistan? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255 or join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the aid scene in Afghanistan, whether we're doing enough now, whether we're prepared to do enough long term to bring Afghanistan back to a viable state that will keep it from turning back into a haven for terrorists. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Jerry Martone. He's Director of Emergency Response for the International Rescue Committee, a U.S.-based aid organization. Foundation, and our special guest news analyst tonight, Juliet Kayyem, with the program on domestic preparedness at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Let's turn to them. Hal is on the line. Welcome, Hal. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks.
Hi.
One comment I wanted to make is someone was talking about using Marine combat engineers and so on. And
yes.
They really aren't trained for that kind of work, but the Navy has a huge corps, the construction battalions, that have been around since the Second World War.
Do you have experience with that, Hal?
Yes, I was in the Seabees in Vietnam.
Can you imagine the Seabees being helpful in a development sense, or do you think that's the wrong role for them?
That's what they do. The original design was that after the Marines hit the beach, the Seabees come ashore and build an air base and have it up and operational in 7 days.
But would you feel comfortable with the idea of them sticking around after the main military effort to build roads and irrigation dams and that kind of thing?
That's what they do. And, in fact, they're equipped to defend themselves, too.
Well, Hal, thanks for the comment. And, Jerry, what about it? There's a former CB saying they could do it, but you're saying you're not so sure that they should.
Well, first of all, he's really right. They very much could. It's their extraordinary capacity to do things like that. But again, that is not what's needed. It's not merely roads, bridges, buildings. These people are farmers, and they need agricultural techniques and simple agricultural commodities. Mm-hmm. And that's where the focus has to be.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call. Bruce is on the line. Welcome, Bruce. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
Just two cautionary notes and one hopeful note. Mm-hmm. The first cautionary note is from World War II, and this is from Stephen Ambrose's book, The Citizen Soldiers.
Yeah.
He says that the material for the Americans fighting in Italy came in through the port of Naples. It came in day and night, and every item was eagerly sought on the black market. One-third of all the supplies that landed in Naples was stolen. In Italy, once an entire train carrying supplies to the front simply disappeared. So at least we got a number about what's likely to disappear, but this is with our own efforts.
That's quite a magic trick, a whole train disappearing.
Yeah. Now, the other thing was to do with the Vietnam War. A cautionary note on turning the military into an agricultural group, or in this case, it was an attempt to eliminate opium. A lot of spraying was done, a lot of ripping up of plants was done, things like that. The result was that the next year, the total production of opium, I think, more than doubled.
Now, why would that be if it was destroyed?
Well, corruption somewhere. That makes it the world's, let's see, if I remember correctly, and I don't exactly have the numbers, but it is the most successful program, agricultural program, ever undertaken by humanity, at least on an ounce of gold per results basis.
And your hopeful note, Bruce, we're ready for it.
Yeah. So if we could do that with wheat, it'd be okay. But opium seems maybe a problem. The encouraging note is a news item that just came out today. An economist named Fehr, F-E-H-R, in Zurich, Switzerland, headed a team that analyzed the economic benefits of cooperation and punishment, and the ability to fine people who transgress. Essentially, security, if you want. And the results were that area or group or effort, I should say, that does not have both rewards and punishments for the transgressors, but rewards for the people who follow the rules, is almost doomed to fail. We've almost got that doubt down to a mathematical basis.
Bruce, thanks for your observations, one and all. Jerry Martone, what about it? Do you see enough of a government structure, formal or informal, emerging in Afghanistan to set the right balance of punishments and rewards and enough order that the development that you're hoping for can take place?
Sadly, the most recent precedent of a successful controlling a government that was able to install law and order was the Taliban. And despite how oppressive and draconian they were, that is one thing they were able to do, was to convert the warlordism and the feudal nature of Afghanistan over the past several years into one where there was relatively less.
Juliet Kime, that's a great point. We've heard it from several people in the last week that the United States is actually already beginning to lose its leverage in Afghanistan. The people on the ground there can feel it slipping away as the government comes in, more importantly, as the warlords come in, back to old pre-Taliban patterns. How does a country that's played this unique role, a little bit on the ground and a lot from the skies that the U.S. has played, maintain the kind of hand in the situation that can keep the environment open for development?
Well, I think first we need to be realistic about what's happening in Afghanistan and to not be ready to judge or condemn. I mean, yesterday we heard that that of several Taliban officials who had apologized and said that they would follow the provisional government and were released. And there seemed
we'll never do it again, right, we promise.
There seemed to be a lot of upset. I think we have to understand there's quite a delicate balance going on in Afghanistan, and we have to be sympathetic to at least the Afghan attempt to strike a good balance. It may not be perfect from our perspective, but in Afghanistan, there are a lot of grays. It's not entirely clear, you know.
But the last time they tried it without a heavy hand was the pre-Taliban era. It was a total mess. The Afghans were so outraged about it that they accepted the Taliban as an alternative.
But imagine that they start to take all Taliban officials and arrest them and put them in detentions or send them to Guantanamo. I mean, that is going to so disrupt Karzai's sort of loose grasp on authority, but also make a lot of Afghanistan people very upset with us. I think we have to be sympathetic with that. The difficulty, this war on terrorism, sort of nebulous aspects of the war on terrorism, I think what the administration needs to start telling the American people probably more clearly is when this war, or what will be the end of this war. We see them moving back from the idea that it's going to be the capture or death of bin Laden. I think that's because we don't know where he is, or if he is dead, we haven't found him yet. And it may be that this war ends with sort of a sustainable, independent Afghanistan. That's not a bad thing. That is actually a very good thing. But that's a very different sell than going after bin Laden. And I think we need to restructure the way we talk about this war as well, because a sort of independent Afghanistan, one that's, that has some independence, some authority, is going to be in the long term sort of one of the best ways to prevent terrorism in the future. And we need to start selling that.
Jerry Martone, from your perspective, at this point, what would you most like from the United States, from the international community? What would be most productive and helpful from your point of view?
Is the perspective of a right diagnosis to recognize this milieu, this breeding ground, which people are considering?
Yes.
That it's a cultural and ideological misunderstanding about the West. The roots of terrorism are poverty and ignorance. Mm-hmm. The remedy is going to be development and education.
And what could the West do that would be most helpful to provide the environment where that development's possible?
Bring our best craftsmanship to bear on foreign assistance. It is the way to do it.
By that you mean developing the programs that get is this kind of Peace Corps thing? Is this AID? What mechanism are you looking toward?
All humanitarian assistance, foreign assistance, AID has been the largest donor so far, particularly in the food sector in Afghanistan. We have to stay the course, however. As Panos mentioned, our interests tend to be a bit fickle, and when the cameras turn away, so doesn't the donor interest. And we have to really stay the course. It takes a long time to rebuild a nation.
Jerry, when you're back in the U.S. or when you're back in Afghanistan, what keeps you up at night? What do you worry most about?
I just worry about the quality of the work that we're trying to do. How are we carrying it out? Is it the right thing? Are we leaving a legacy of self-reliance as opposed to a legacy of dependence?
Are you optimistic?
Yeah, very much. I think the level of practice in our field of humanitarian assistance has improved so dramatically over the last several years, the way we do it and the way we think about our work, and our involvement of the very people we're trying to help.
Ten years out, do you see a viable Afghanistan?
That's hard for me to predict. That's a political scenario that's beyond me. I sure hope so, Tom. I sure hope so.
Jerry Martone, it's been great to have you tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Jerry Martone is Director of Emergency Response for the International Rescue Committee. So, Juliet Kime, there it is. Jerry's into his work, and he wants to develop Afghanistan, and he doesn't want more military. He wants more farming. But the framework that makes that possible is what we sit here worrying about.
Right. I mean, I understand what Jerry's saying in terms of the kind of things that are needed in Afghanistan and making it an independent country, but how we're going to do that politically within the United States is more difficult. As we were talking about earlier, our sort of sustainable interest in Afghanistan is going to wane dramatically as we stop bombing and if some of these guys are captured. And the challenge for us, and I hope it's one that we rise to, is that we do stay committed to Afghanistan and countries like Afghanistan.
It's a question of commitment. Juliet Kime, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Juliet Kime runs the Domestic Preparedness Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. You can continue this conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. David Karras is a photographer living in Belmont, Massachusetts. He photographs other artists' work for portfolios and galleries. In this radio diary, he says much of his clients' artwork now reflects a post-September 11th psyche, and he says that his own work has taken on a new meaning since that day.
I asked a lot of my clients if they were feeling this or what the situation was. And what I find is that artists initially were taking time and reflecting and looking back and trying to figure out, wait a minute, what is important right now in this world? Is it the art? Is it what is happening in this world? Is there a war that's about to take place in the United States, on the United States, in the Middle East? 2.5 years ago, since the fire of my studio and 35 other artist studios got totally destroyed, I started questioning what the meaning of my work was, what direction I may or may not go in from this point on in my life, having lost so much to the fire. What I realized after the fire 2.5 years ago was that I wanted to focus on something that had more meaning to me. I started to travel to Cuba, photographing Cuba in such a way that I was documenting. I found myself documenting Cuba as a completely different culture, which it is. I found myself searching out something there in terms of the visuals. I've been photographing the people there. I've been photographing street scenes, the way they live, their lifestyle. And I've also met a number of wonderful people there, Cubans. The first time I went to Cuba, I came back after a week and a half, and my wife met me at the airport. As I started to describe what my experience was in Cuba, I found myself emotionally breaking down. I lost it. I was so upset by what I had experienced there, how unfair this world is, how imbalanced it is. September 11th happened, and I realized that it's not just Cuba. There's great imbalance, there's great injustice in this world. September 11th happened for a reason, and I feel that what I'm doing now with my artwork and what I'm seeing some of the other artists that are coming into my studio to be documented, what is happening is that the work has changed for some people. It has affected them. The work they are now producing since September 11th is quite different from what they were producing prior to September 11th. And it turns out that it's the emotional effect it's had on them and is having on them. My work, I now see that I want to spend more time for myself to be able to go and photograph, document issues that are relevant to what has happened and what is happening in this world. That's what I find myself doing with Cuba. Well, what I find interesting with the changes on some of the artwork that's being done is that some of these artists do not realize there is a change going on until they've produced a fair body of work. And then sometimes they'll bring it in here for me to photograph. And then when they're sitting there while I'm photographing, they'll look at it and say, you know, this is really interesting. I am actually looking at it now. And this is what I'm realizing that my work has changed. This is what I'm doing now, and a lot of it has to do with my response to September 11th and my response to the world today as what is going on and the uncertainty of things that are going on right now. It's quite interesting.
David Karras lives in Belmont, Massachusetts. You can listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.